Georgia's DBHDD has an urgent health warning. One of every 10 counterfeit pills contain fentanyl, a powerful and very deadly drug. Pills from friends or dealers are unsafe, and one pill can cause an overdose. More info at opioidresponse.info.
We're beginning another brand new week here on Political Rewind. Having taken off yesterday, Indigenous Peoples Day, which some of you prefer to continue calling Columbus Day, we think Indigenous Peoples Day makes a lot of sense. So we got a lot to talk about because we did take a three-day weekend, and I want to get right to our panel. It's Tuesday, which means Tamar Hallerman, senior reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is with us. Hi, Tamar. How are you?
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Glad to have you. Stephen Fowler is with us, GPB's political reporter. Stephen, early voting starts today. People like you and me, we get really excited as political journalists when elections get underway.
It always seems to be election season, and this one, there's a lot of interesting things to follow.
Absolutely. Atiyah Mitchell is with us. She, of course, is the Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Atiyah, I hesitate to say you've got a slower week up there because it never really slows down, but they're out this week, except they're rushing back to vote on to take a vote over about something to do with the debt ceiling, right?
Yes, they're going to the House is expected later today to go ahead and ratify what they need to do to avoid a default on America's debt. So that is probably going to be the only action in Washington, but I'm actually in Georgia for the week.
Oh, terrific. Are you here to cover some politics?
Yeah, just to catch up with folks. So if you're listening, hit me up. I'm available for meetings.
Right. Well, Tia, we're glad you're here for our show today. And Kurt Young, the chairman of the Political Science Department and a political science professor at Clark Atlanta University, is with us today. Kurt, how are you?
Doing well, Bill. Looking forward to this conversation.
I want to start, if I may, with a talk about the fact that early voting starts today, a three-week period that will continue until what I now think of, as I think many of us think of, as the last day of voting as opposed to Election Day, November 2nd, since so many people now are voting early. And Tamar, we're going to talk in just a second about how the mayor's race in Atlanta, which is certainly a premier race across the ballots, is shaping up at this point. But before we do that, let's point out, Tamar, there are elections taking place all across the state. Local elections, there are T-splots, E-splots, there are mayoral elections, city council races. So people who are not clear on whether they have elections in their community should go to the Secretary of State's website tomorrow, figure out what they may want to start thinking about voting for.
Absolutely. Acronyms aplenty with a lot of these initiatives coming up. But of course, the premier one, as you mentioned, is the Atlanta mayor's race. And so many interesting themes to be watching. Of course, this comeback bid by former Mayor Kasim Reed, it seems very likely that he'll end up in a runoff with Felicia Moore or whoever the second place finisher might be. There's some polls that shows Kasim Reed in second place. So it'll be very interesting to see how that shapes out. And of course, this vote in, how all of this could impact this cityhood movement in Buckhead. All of the candidates say they don't want that to happen, but of course there's plenty at stake. And on Sunday, there was a debate that WSB-TV held with the Atlanta Police Foundation over crime, the top issue. And it's one that candidates are talking about everywhere because they know that is the issue on voters' minds.
So let's talk a little bit more about the what happened in that debate Sunday. And let's start with the fact that there were some clashes, Stephen Fowler. Over the weekend, two attorneys for Kasim Reed released information that they say they learned from federal investigators that they are no longer looking at Kasim Reed as having any involvement in the scandals that have plagued City Hall. We haven't known at all whether they are still investigating him for corruption. Any number of people in his administration have already been caught. So despite that, Stephen, on Sunday, the Felicia Moore said that this was an administration, Reed's administration, one that had been plagued by scandal, and that's what we'd get in another term from Kasim Reed, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that have already developed opinions about Kasim Reed and his relationship with ethics based on his time in office. And clearly, even though Reed himself might not be under investigation anymore, many people that were in his circle and extended circle did face prosecution and charges and things for ethical lapses and this culture that was under Reed's administration. So it's still, like Felicia Moore said, you know, she said it will not be scandal-free because it's not scandal-free now, because, you know, it's not a completely pure and blameless, you know, nothing was wrong under Reed's tenure. And so the question is, you know, the Atlanta of 2021 is a lot different than the Atlanta of 2017. And how will the voters that are in the city now, paying attention to things like the Cop City vote that Atlanta City Council did, paying attention to reactions to crime and racial justice protests and housing and other top issues, you know, is Kasim Reed ready for the 2021 Atlanta that we're currently in?
Kurt, I want to pick up on what Stephen basically said. I think he was suggesting that people have already made up their mind about Kasim Reed one way or the other in terms of whether or not he was at the head of a city administration that allowed corruption to flourish. And the question becomes whether or not it is too late to change that impression among people who have been watching this unfold for years now.
And there's something else that's changing in the city compared to his last go-around, which has to do with some of the demographic shifts that's taken place, that has taken place in the city. And so I agree with the point. The city may be a different playing field as it was prior to that. Now, how does that relate to this notion that there are many who have already had, they already have their minds made up? Well, that's true, but you also have a segment of the population who may be reacting to different dynamics than this issue of crime, right? So I think what the Reed campaign is banking on is that they can tap into this new era by touching on this matter of crime. The argument is that crime is on the increase in the city in a way that it hadn't been under his mayoralship. However, there is a different discussion. For example, and I appreciate the point around housing, affordable housing, discussions around racial justice and social justice matters. All of these factors will come to bear in this election. In addition to, and I say this every time I'm on the show, Bill, in addition to the extent to which the Atlanta mayoral race is also a reflection of the statewide dynamics, regional dynamics, and national political dynamics, right? And so I think that it's just a matter of time before those kind of factors begin to weigh in. And I do want to say that we're also looking at a possible runoff. I'm not sure if someone mentioned this already, but we're headed to a kind of runoff, which would then amplify these other issues, even among those who may have had their minds made up with regard to how they see Reed and some of the other candidates.
Yeah, Tamar, we have not seen a poll on this race, at least a poll by a news organization, since the Atlanta Constitution poll. I think Channel 11 had a poll, but the one that I'm looking at now goes back to mid-September when the AJC published a poll, and Tamar, it did show that Kasim Reed and Felicia Moore are basically in an almost statistical dead heat, with all the other candidates trailing far behind. But that same poll showed that more than 40% of voters, at least in mid-September, were undecided, which gave some hope to the Sharon Gays and Andre Dickens of the campaign.
Yeah, and it was about 41% of voters who in the AJC poll said they were undecided in September. And that's a pretty high number for at this point in the cycle. Of course, that number is likely to have gone down. But it goes to show how much work these candidates have been trying to do to just get their name out and try and appeal to people. But with so many candidates on the ballot, there's something like 14. It's going to be very hard for somebody like Kasim Reed or Felicia Moore to avoid a runoff. So at this point, the question is who it's going to be. And if Kasim Reed has one of those spots, which seems very likely, is that other candidate going to be able to capitalize on the anyone but Kasim Reed vote? And it seems like a lot of people are going after him to make sure that person can be them.
And I think that's why Felicia Moore has become so attractive to the anyone but Kasim crowd, because we know that with Atlanta and those changing demographics that people have mentioned already on this panel, there's going to be a lot of thoughtfulness and a lot of quote unquote identity politics, if you will, that feed into the runoff. And I think there are a lot of people in that anyone but Kasim crowd who are worried about Kasim Reed taking advantage of that if his opponent in the runoff is Sharon Gay or a white person, if we're going to be frank about it. And so I think that the people who are looking into Kasim Reed in a runoff, who do we think will be better? Kind of think about back in 2020 when Democrats were saying up against Donald Trump, who do we think can beat him head to head? Not necessarily who's our favorite. Who do we think can beat him head to head? And I think that crowd who's looking at that for Kasim Reed thinks that Felicia Moore will do better head to head than perhaps some of these other candidates. And I think that's why, number one, you're seeing support coalesce around her, but you're also seeing Kasim Reed supporters starting to focus on Felicia Moore, which I think also tells you a lot in that they're attacking her.
Stephen, let me get you back in, and then I know Tamar, you want to weigh in as well. Go back to that mid-September poll by the AJC to look at a number that kind of confirms what we're saying about whether Kasim Reed is out from under the shadow of the federal investigation that went on for so long. It, as of that poll, and there's no reason why this figure would have changed, I don't think, in the week since then. As of that poll, 22%, that's it, only 22% of the people polled say they have yet to make up their mind about Kasim Reed. So a lot of people already knew what they felt about him. And back then, the majority of people were unhappy about Kasim Reed. So it does show that even though he's up there, likely to be in a runoff, he's had work to do to try to get into that position.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you take it as a composite. Most people know what they feel about Kasim Reed, and a large chunk of Atlanta voters don't know who they're going to vote for and support in the mayoral race. That means that for a candidate like Felicia Moore, you know, or somebody that makes a runoff, you know, kind of like Tia was saying, is that there is a calculation of getting to a runoff and then voting for somebody who's not Kasim Reed. You know, there may be 14 candidates on the ballot, but maybe four of them are viable to get to the point of a runoff. And so I think the question of who that second person is not as clear cut. You know, many polls have Felicia Moore there. She's the city council president. She's a known figure, just like Antonio Brown is an Atlanta city council member, just like Andre Dickens is an Atlanta city council member. So I think you're still seeing how this is shaking out of figuring out who the anyone but Kasim lane is. And I think the latest campaign finance filings show that it's really, you know, either Sharon Gay, Felicia Moore, or Andre Dickens that are the ones that are getting the financial support.
you can see just how much the temperature is rising. What was so interesting about the Sunday debate on WSB was just how it's the most I've seen them truly attack each other, and especially Kasim Reed kind of hitting back. You know, and initially he was kind of cruising a little bit, but he really went hard after Felicia Moore, after she mentioned all the, you know, the City Hall corruption probe and stuff like that. He really drilled in on votes she took on the city council having to do with property tax rates, affordable housing, that sort of thing. He also went after Andre Dickens, who in some polls I've seen has been rising, and obviously they have a long history together. And so you're seeing the candidates in their actions. You know, you can see not desperation, but just how people are so aware that this is going to be a runoff and they need to start wounding their opponents.
You know, it's interesting. We had at Clark Atlanta University, we had two mayoral forums. The second one was open to a larger audience. So we invited all 14. In the first one, though, we only had five leading candidates. And you can tell, Tamar, at that first session, you can see them, the other candidates, begin to test. I won't necessarily argue that they were testing, but they were certainly beginning to chip away at Reed's record in the past, these accusations of corruption and what have you. And the difference between then and just the other day was that then Reed seemed to respond in standing on the strength of his record, right? He didn't quite attack. What I heard just recently in the debate that we're discussing now was where he did seem to turn his sights in more of an attack mode. Of course, we'll have to see where that leads. Especially as his opponents become even more sharpened in their critique, and specific in their critique of his previous record.
Okay, before we move on, because Tamar, you made a note of it. The fundraising in the campaign really shows Kasim Reed with an enormous advantage. He's raised something like $2.8 million as of the most recent reporting period. He has almost $1 million cash on hand. He'll have more to finish the final 3 weeks. Felicia Moore has raised $1.1 million and has about 450 or so thousand on hand. Sharon Gay has got, she raised $1.7 million, but more than a million of that is from her own personal resources. She lent herself that money. And so fundraising is not the election, but it is clear that Kasim Reed continues to have the power to attract big dollars from many funders. We should also point out Andre Dickens had raised $1 million, and so he's done relatively well too. What should we make of that, if anything, Stephen?
Well, I mean, I think what you make of it is, obviously you've got Kasim Reed that has high name identification. Felicia Moore has high name identification. Sharon Gay, most of the money that she's raised, like you said, 2/3 of it is self-loans, but most of the money that she spent is on media buys and other things, getting her name out there and telling people about her record and what she wants to do. And so, fundraising does not equal election results, but it is a really good proxy for what that message is and how effectively it's being received. You know, Andre Dickens as well, raising a lot of money, surging in the polls, getting his information out there. And so I think the money pouring in both from inside city limits and from really all over the country, because Kasim had fundraisers in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., shows that there are people paying attention to this mayor's race, and it's not necessarily going to be something that's low energy, low interest, low turnout.
I want to move on from the mayor's race. We still have plenty of time to talk about it in the weeks ahead. But I do want to point out that the mayoral candidates are going to debate again today, tonight. The GPB TV we'll have a debate starting at 7 o'clock on TV and at gpb.org, also Atlanta Press Club Facebook page. and that's going to happen from 7 to 8. That's with the upper half of the candidates polling in the upper half. Earlier than that, from 5 to 6, GPB-TV will air second half, the lower tier of candidates debating. So you'll get a chance to see all of them in action on GPB-TV and at gpb.org tonight. That's a partnership with the Atlanta Press Club. Let's do this. Let's get our first break of the show out of the way. When we come back, a lot more to talk about on today's Political Rewind. We're joined today by Tamar Hallerman of the AJC, Stephen Fowler, GPB News, Tia Mitchell, Washington reporter for the AJC, and Kurt Young, chair of the Political Science Department at Clark Atlanta University. You know, with elections unfolding across the state starting today, Stephen, you were really deeply involved in looking at what the Senate Bill 202, the new election laws in Georgia, how it was going to impact voting. And this is the first election in which we'll see some of those new provisions being in practice in the election. So as an example, Stephen, I've already gotten emails from a number of listeners who have been very distressed about the amount of time that they had to get absentee votes in. Getting applications for absentee votes. They say that the process has been foreshortened in such a way that they're having a very difficult time voting. But that's only one of a number of changes that are going to could have an impact on this election, right, Stephen?
Right. So one of the biggest changes is absentee voting. The window to request a ballot is a lot narrower than it was before. So you have to submit it much closer to the election. The deadline is a week earlier, so you can't request it the Friday before. It's got to be 2 weeks before. Still has to be received by Election Day, but, you know, and there are also changes to the application that has a new identification requirement to it, but also for early voting. Today's the first day of early voting. Some counties may add more weekend early voting options in future elections. Maybe not necessarily the municipal elections because they're lower turnouts and, you know, not every polling place is used because not every place has an election. But then there's also going to be nice tests for some of the changes that should make the vote counting go faster, like processing the absentee ballots earlier and requiring elections officials to count all the votes without stopping. Taking a little bit of breaks here and there. So there's a lot of changes. Many we won't see the full effect of for these municipal elections because they will be lower overall turnout. There won't be 5 million people voting in the next couple weeks.
Tia, meanwhile, it's interesting that the effort in Congress to pass a federal voting law, Democrats in the House, who have really pushed hard for a John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which was so prominently part of the news headlines for quite a while, has really faded as the Congress and the White House wrestle with the infrastructure bill, wrestle with the social policy agenda that President Biden's been trying to put forward. And it does feel as the federal voting effort is really gotten to a point where we're just not, I mean, we're not counting on getting very far with it in the Senate, are we, Tia?
Right. And it's not just the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. There's also a new kind of compromise voting rights bill that moderate Senator Joe Manchin helped negotiate. So they came down from kind of they modified a little bit of their position in hopes of getting Republicans to at least agree to overcome the filibuster. And that's not happening either. So really, it's stalled because in the Senate, you have the filibuster. You need 10 Republicans to let Democrats move forward on these voting bills, and that is not happening. So without a change to the filibuster, which doesn't look like it's happening either, these voting rights proposals at the federal level are going nowhere, which means that each individual state is allowed to kind of take its voting laws where the leaders of the state want to go. And then, as we see in conservative states that Joe Biden won, like Georgia, they're passing these new laws that we're now talking about.
Kurt, jump in on this.
Well, you know, when part of what's happening, I think, on the Hill, Bill, is that I think the Biden administration is really confronted with the challenges facing conventional wisdom, right? On the one hand, there is an expectation that the candidate or the party that holds the White House will lose seats in Congress, right? That's kind of a conventional wisdom. But now you're seeing the Biden administration's agenda being swallowed up with this debate around these two bills, right? Whether it's the infrastructure bill on the one hand versus the Build Back Better bill. And so we're seeing the attempt by the Biden administration to try to push these particular agenda items forward in the middle of an environment that betrays conventional wisdom. We're looking at an environment that where the electorate is split right down the middle, right? There's a kind of an evaporating middle, a swing vote or middle, I don't want to say middle class, but a middle section of the electorate that can kind of be counted upon to swing with given the given direction of the discussion. I think that we're losing that perspective. There's also all of this unfolding in the context of a global pandemic, right? And so I think that the big concern in Congress right now is that everything is going to be held hostage until the administration figures out a way to get past these this conundrum with regard to these two bills. And I don't know that I see a smooth landing in the future. I think, and then there's one other piece that I think is important, Bill, to add. The Democratic Party is grappling with a newfound level of strength among a progressive segment of the party, right? The recent history has been that in situations like this, remember, in situations like this, this isn't new. What the progressive wing of the party would have done in the past would have been to capitulate on what might have been defined as pragmatic, right? In the conversation right now, the discussion is to label the infrastructure bill as the pragmatic bill. And it's causing a change in the discussion in the sense that the progressive are no longer falling in line in terms of that tendency in the past. And I think the Biden administration is having to make sense of all of this with this midterm election looming just a year from now.
It's interesting you take us in that direction, Kurt, because Tamar, that's all of a sudden in the last few days, and Tia, you're going to want to weigh in on this too, I know. We are seeing an increasing number of stories coming out of national news organizations saying that for the first time, Democrats are now really, really worried that President Biden's approval ratings, his perception among voters, even if you're not counted in those approval ratings, has shifted dramatically. And Democrats are beginning to be very concerned about whether or not 2022 is in jeopardy because the president is having so much difficulty with his agenda and coming across as being seen as strong by many people. And Tamar, the word malaise has been used a couple of times about Joe Biden. And we haven't heard that word used about a president of the United States since Jimmy Carter. And we know that stuck to him for decades.
And he's in a tough spot because I think Democrats realize that when else, or it's going to be a long time before, you know, it's rare in Washington now for one party to kind of control the White House, the House, and the Senate at the same time. And so people sort of know that it's almost this like once in a decade opportunity where this is their moment to kind of push through their agenda. As Kurt alluded to, you know, midterm elections tend to be a really bad time for the party in power, and Democrats are expected to lose the House, if not the Senate, where they have the barest majorities in both chambers. So I think Democrats are very much aware that this is their moment to do much of anything for Joe Biden. And I think that's why you're seeing the Democrats so divided and kind of taking both parts of his agenda hostage, this infrastructure bill and this huge social spending package. You know, the liberals who want the social spending package know that moderates desperately want infrastructure. And so they're kind of holding that bit hostage. And so it makes it really, really hard if you're Joe Biden, who just wants to get anything done. You're seeing, you know, approval ratings really shrink. He's down, I think, to the low 40s in what I've seen. And I think you have moderates like Carolyn Bordeaux, who are really hoping that something like an infrastructure bill can help them hold on to their seats. And, you know, I don't know how this is going to end. Maybe Tia can shed a little more light on it.
Well, I was going to say, Tamar, you have the D.C. experience, so I always defer to you. But I think that Democrats will get something done eventually because they know that their window is closing. It is highly unlikely that they will keep the House after November's midterms, next November's midterms. And they also could lose control of the Senate. And I think they want to do something sooner rather than later. Speaker Pelosi wrote her colleagues a letter just last night. She's starting to lay out a path forward, which is instead of doing everything a little bit less to lower the price tag of that big sweeping social spending and climate change bill, she's now advocating doing a few things well. From the Democratic standpoint, of course. So I do think eventually it's messy right now, and it's all Democrats. So, yes, Democrats are suffering from the public perception that, you know, that's the byproduct of being in control and of government in Washington. You get all the benefits, but you also get all the blame. And also, I will say that Republicans know this, and so all they can do is be obstructionists, you know. And that's why Republicans, especially Mitch McConnell, chaos is kind of part of their goal. And amplifying Democrats' inability thus far to get on one accord, amplifying that, making it look like this disaster is also something that Republicans are doing right now. Because, again, that's kind of their role right now is in the minority. I do think Democrats will be able to get something. The question is, will it be able to translate to the people back home, not just what was done, but how will it benefit people? That's something I think Democrats are really nervous about, that, again, the messaging is not translating to, like, Democrats did this and it's beneficial.
It goes to show about all the distrust in Washington. We always talk about Democrats mistrusting Republicans and vice versa. But what's so interesting about all of this is it's showing the extent of the mistrust that's happening within parties, within the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And all of this is happening because they have the barest of majorities in both chambers. All it takes in the Senate, which is 50-50 right now, is one senator to kind of mess it all up or tap the brakes. And so you're seeing a lot of frustration with people like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, among other Democrats. And you're seeing it in the House as well with the progressives and the more central blue dog. So, you know, they have to remember that they're on the same team, that Republicans are not going to help them because it's not their jobs to help them, or at least that's not where the political system is right now. And so they're going to have to take a leap and at some point pass something. But as Tia mentions, I wonder how much voters will really, you know, how much it'll really register to voters. I don't think they really care as much about the minutia of all of this. At some point, they just want to get something done and politics be damned.
Stephen, you know, it is conceivable, as Tia points out, that they'll figure out some way to pass some version of the social policy agenda along with the infrastructure bill. But one thing that apparently the president's numbers are reflecting is something that cannot be resolved by coming together or by compromise, the coronavirus. You know, with the Delta variant continuing to surge, with concerns about whether we're ever going to get out of this mess. It's had a major impact on President Biden, and that's not there. And there's another catch-22 to that, because so many of the reasons we're told by public health officials that the virus continues is those who are not vaccinated are spreading it. And in many ways, those are Republicans. So, Stephen, the president in a bind that's hurting him.
Yeah, I mean, everything has become a polarized issue, whether it's handling the virus, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's voting rights, or, you know, you name it. Everything is an antagonistic issue. And we see that with the coronavirus. We see that with responses over potential mandates, over vaccine mandates, or schools, masking, and different policies for schools. And it just is kind of a losing proposition. But as more time passes, more people are vaccinated, or more people have been sickened with COVID-19 and have some sort of natural immunity, or unfortunately are passed away because of the virus, that the more time passes, hopefully, the less of an impact it will have, and things will be able to, quote unquote, go back to normal, even though there is no such thing as normal anymore. But, you know, now there are concerns about the holidays, and we get mixed messaging from federal health officials about what you can do for Thanksgiving and what you can do for Christmas. And it just certainly doesn't help matters.
Yeah. And then you add to that the kind of the other issues that are triggered by the, that have been triggered by this pandemic, that happened to just the very basic ways that people interact, and the frustrations of not being able to get back to life as normal, right? And the extent to which that's reflected in poll numbers and frustrations among the electorate. But, you know, Bill, I'd like to add, I think Tamar made an important point that I'd like to just add a few points to quickly. You mentioned the razor thin lead that the Democrats have in these in the two houses of Congress, right, in the Senate and in the House of Representatives, and it's made it even more. It's amplified the extent to which there's a bit of frustration in the administration to fall back on at least two possible ways to address that problem. One possible way is to deal with the filibuster, right? And to change the filibuster, the structure of the filibuster, and the votes necessary. And then another way, you know, there's no saying that says that Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. And there seems to be a discussion that says that the administration is not being tough enough on the two senators who seem to be standing in front of key parts of the agenda. I think part of what the administration is grappling with is an increasing level of frustration among those who want him to Biden to do more in pressing those two issues. But I think all of it, though, I agree, Bill, connects to this issues around these issues around the virus, the pandemic.
All right. Kurt Young gets the last word in this segment of Political Rewind. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, I'm going to turn to Stephen first. Stephen Fowler, I'm going to ask you, what the heck are we learning about some 300 ballot registration applications being shredded in Fulton County? We'll do that and more after these messages. Stephen Fowler, you reported a story, and I think you may have been the first one to get this story, that Fulton County election officials have fired two workers because they were seen shredding something like 300 voter registration applications. Just to be clear, not ballots, not even absentee ballot requests, voter registration requests. Tell us a little more about this story.
So to register to vote in Georgia, most people use an online portal that the Secretary of State has, or it's done automatically by interacting with the Department of Driver Services. You know, you get a new driver's license, they update your voter registration. But you can still register to vote on a paper form, and that's what is in discussion here in Fulton County. Apparently, allegedly, two Fulton County workers decided to shred
several paper voter application forms instead of fully process them. Now, that's against the law that says all election materials must be stored for 24 months after the election. It's also not good because if shredded, we don't know how many of those 300 applications were legitimate new registrations or updated registrations, or if they were illegible and you couldn't process them anyway, or if they were things like Mickey Mouse, things that wouldn't be real voter registrations anyway. We also don't know a lot because as soon as it happened, Fulton County says they investigated, fired the two workers, notified the Secretary of State's office, and notified the Fulton County District Attorney. So it's in investigation mode and everyone's got tight lips, except for the Secretary of State's office, who used this opportunity to call for the Department of Justice to get involved. And now, also want to be clear, Georgia doesn't have party registrations. So it's not like somebody shredded a bunch of Democratic applications or Republican applications. It's not a partisan thing, but especially with Fulton County already under the microscope, it's really, really puzzling behavior at a really, really bad time. And already I've seen a ton of conspiracies from the left and the right about what happened and what this means.
Yeah, and I just think I get why Fulton election officials wanted to respond so quickly, so publicly. They want to look like they're being transparent and they're doing it the right way. And that as soon as we saw a problem, we fired those people, we reported it up the chain, we did everything right, because they didn't want blowback. But it's also like almost like a catch-22, because they went public so quickly, but with very little details, and that is allowing people to fill in the blanks and create their own conspiracy theories and to read between the lines. And so it looks very bad, and we don't really have the details to really say what happened. And I think that's not serving them well, because the people who do want an excuse to say, see, this is why Fulton County should be taken over, this is why Fulton County's still a mess, this is feeding into their narrative, absent of the truth and absent of details. And again, I don't necessarily think that keeping quiet would have helped either, because then that would have been a whole nother issue. But I think it just shows how sensitive Fulton County elected officials are to this whole state takeover issue, how sensitive they are to looking like they don't have it together. And to your point, Stephen, I'm sure how ticked off they are at these two employees, even if they thought they were doing the right thing, because that's what we don't know. These employees may have thought they were doing the right thing and maybe just didn't know the record retention policies, or, you know, thought that they were duplicates and they didn't have to. But it's just caused a mess.
All right, let's be careful here, because you're right, Tia, we don't know. But I think we do know that that what happened here probably was done in it seems it was done in an irresponsible way. Any way you would do this would be irresponsible. But Tamar, the real question becomes, just what kind of impact does this have when Republicans get back in the Capitol and start looking at whether they want to activate their right to take over a local election board? And this is a great opportunity for them to think about doing that with Fulton County. But it goes beyond that. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, when we see things like this happen, we suddenly recognize that systems that we've taken for granted for years are more fragile than we ever thought. The electoral apparatus depends on people doing things correctly. And in the last election cycles or so, we've suddenly started wondering about how that process unfolds.
Sure. And even just kind of the human part of it, where you realize there are humans, you know, involved, and, you know, maybe this was something nefarious, or maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was just, you know, stupidity, or somebody didn't know what they were doing. But either way, it doesn't look good. And as you mentioned, as the legislature starts to look at this, a lot of nuance quickly falls away once politicians get involved. Fulton has long been under the microscope. They had a very disastrous primary day in 2020. And so this certainly isn't going to make them any more allies in the legislature.
Kurt?
Well, you know, I think we saw this coming in terms of the, let me back up a little bit. In addition to those dynamics we just mentioned, you mentioned, Bill, or someone mentioned that this is a human enterprise, right? And so I would argue that there's always been, we've always had these kind of unfortunate mishaps take place in these elections. It's always been the case because they're run by human beings who are flawed. Right? The difference now is that the environment is so charged that everything is amplified, right? Everything is now exaggerated in the sense that it becomes a political lightning rod. The question, though, I would ask is the extent to which it can be seen as a piling on effect that would trigger, as they say, an equal and opposite reaction, right? The extent to which Fulton County, let's be clear, Fulton County was clear, was key in the electing, in the 2020 election, just as you saw in these various urban settings throughout the country, whether it's from the Philadelphia area, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And so once again, Atlanta will and Fulton County will figure squarely into what will come out of this election, as well as the 2022 elections, and there can be a response to that as an example of piling on, or stated differently, the Senate bill actually producing the kind of disenfranchisement of the electoral base in Fulton County as one was criticizing it to be in the first place.
So, Stephen, to put a period on this part of the discussion, do we expect to hear more about this, or is this just going to, the Secretary of State's office going to choose not to tell us more about what may have happened here, or Fulton County, rather, tell us more about what may have happened?
I mean, I suspect we will hear more soon, because I would also say that this is actually an example of the system working as it should. And somebody saw something happen. They said something to the Fulton County superiors. They have the evidence. That's how they know that there's 300. They put out a statement saying, here's how to check your registration. If you think you're concerned, call us, let us know. If you show up to vote and your registration is not there, vote provisional and we will investigate it and make sure this works. I mean, there are humans involved in every part of the election process, and nothing is ever going to be perfect. In an ideal world, there's not employees shredding things, but, you know, this wasn't covered up. They reported it immediately. They took quick action. And for the people that might be affected, they're not going to be disenfranchised if there were real people affected in this. So yeah. I would argue it works.
I'm really glad you made that point. Yes, humans are involved in every step of this. And most of the time we know that fraud isn't involved in elections. And in the long run, many elections are gotten right by the very people who are handling them. All right. Just briefly, we don't have a lot of time, but Politico had a story, speaking of election officials, about Brad Raffensperger the other day. Here's the lead. Donald Trump never wastes an opportunity to attack Georgia's top statewide Republican office holders for failing to help him overturn the 2020 election results. Brad Raffensperger is the only one who refuses to shut up and take it. Raffensperger, who has borne the brunt of Trump's wrath as the top election official in the state, is running a damn the torpedoes reelection campaign that directly confronts the former president, even though it could cost him the GOP nomination. So in a way, Tamar, I think that lead, it's very dramatic, but I think it sort of overstates the case. Yes, Raffensperger continues to insist that the election was legitimate, contrary to what Trump believes. But he's taken a lot of other actions in which he's trying to use the power of his office to hint at his concern about how elections unfold, like referring the shredding to DOJ.
Exactly. And you see, his comments about Stacey Abrams, comparing Stacey Abrams recently to Donald Trump. So this is still a man who's running in a Republican primary for re-election next year. So, there's a great quote in this Politico story from Lynn Westmoreland, a former congressman from Western Georgia, who I used to cover on the Hill, who said, just kind of talking about the long odds that Brad Raffensperger faces and how he saw an internal poll with 87% of Republican primary voters who felt like the election was stolen. Quote, with these kinds of numbers, I just don't see Brad getting through the primary. And so, people nationally are closely watching this race, and I think it'll be interesting to see. But I think a lot of folks don't think Brad Raffensperger has much of a future in Republican elected politics going forward.
Tia?
Yeah, and I think one of the differences for Brad Raffensperger is he's got someone with name recognition, big Trump approval, and a record in Jody Heiss that is a formidable primary opponent, whereas Brian Kemp is able to, looks like he may get past his primary because he doesn't have such stiff competition in the primary.
Stephen, a quick word from you before we leave.
Counterpoint, David Belle Isle is also running a very aggressive campaign that could end up splitting the Trump vote to help Raffensperger in a runoff, because David Belle Isle is actually out there running campaign ads, attacking Brad and Jody, and kind of having a more resonant messaging that is implied within the Trump endorsement that Jody Heiss just isn't putting out on the campaign trail. So we could see things split.
All right. All this means that not only are we going to have fun watching the municipal and local elections in 2021, but we've got more than a year ahead of us of election news to cover here on Politico Rewind. Stephen Fowler, Kurt Young, Tia Mitchell, Tamar Hallerman, thank you so much for a great conversation, getting us started after a three-day weekend. We're here for the rest of the week, back again with a new show tomorrow. In the meantime, I'm Bill Nigut. Take care, stay healthy, wear your mask indoors, and now really is the time to go get a flu shot if you haven't had that one yet, because I already know you're vaccinated for COVID. See y'all tomorrow.